Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations. Speaking will be former Foreign Minister and Vice Chancellor of Germany, Joschka Fischer. Mr. Fischer's lecture is titled Germany and the Future of Europe. We begin with an introduction by International Relations Department Chairman Eric Goldstein.
The Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University serves as a forum for new nonpartisan debate, research, and education in the matters of international, especially transatlantic relations. It is especially interested in the intersection of international relations and culture and the exchange of ideas across national boundaries. The focus of the Max Kader Lecture is to increase understanding of German politics, culture, and society among the American public and to promote new ways of thinking about Germany based on knowledge and not old stereotypes. This year's lecture, Germany and the Future of Europe, will be given by Joschka Fischer, Foreign Minister and Vice Chancellor of Germany from 1998 to 2005. Mr. Fischer entered the Bundestag in 1983. In 1985, he became Minister for the Environment in the first Social Democrat Green Coalition. Later, he became co-chairman of the Greens Parliamentary Party in the Bundestag. In September 1998, the Social Democrats, led by Gerhard Schröder, defeated the Christian Democrat government of Helmut Kohl. With the SPD 42% and the Greens 7% of the result, a coalition government was formed and Joschka Fischer became Minister of Foreign Affairs, a position he served until 2005 in when the coalition government was defeated. Mr. Fischer.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to everybody. It's a great honor to be invited. And maybe Boston is a good place to talk about the future of Europe. When I look up in the sky, I see all the planes going to Europe or coming in from Europe. So this might be the American city, which is closely bound to Europe. If we look to the history of the EU, the European Union, it's a great success story, if you look back. 62 years ago, when the military leadership of Nazi Germany signed unconditional surrender, terrible crimes took place. The concentration camp, concentration camps, at the top of these crimes, Germans' responsibility for the Holocaust, the Shoah, tens of millions of displaced people, countries devastated, refugees, prisoner of wars, millions of prisoner of wars, a continent in ruins. And even the courageous United Kingdom was almost at the verge of bankruptcy in 1945. This was a war-torn continent, and it's strange that 55 years later an American intellectual described Europe as Venus. I mean, it demonstrates great progress that these continent, war-torn continent, Europe, where we had over centuries wars going back and forth, suddenly seemed to be the world of Venus, so a peaceful continent. I never understood that as a blame. I saw that as a great success, knowing our history very well. Now, Europe is not Venus, but it's a great success story. And it should be reminded that this success story, sorry, Monsieur Consulate General, was mostly driven by the United States. I, for myself, had forgotten that the Truman and Eisenhower administration were encouraging money, were supporting money, were in a bitter dispute with the United Kingdom, which was rejecting from the very beginning a supranational Europe. So America was behind the European integration process, and it's very simple to explain why. Because at that time, you had in both parties statesmen with, a strong capacity for analysis, and they understood also history. And they understood if Europe will not change its system, its state system, its political system, there is no guarantee that the mess of World War I and World War II, including all the ramifications, won't come back. So the idea was, or the understanding at that time, that the old European state system, as it had emerged out of the 30 Years' War in 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia, that this state system, a pre-modern state system, pre-industrialized state system, was based on the balance of power. Europe invented the modern state, the concept of sovereignty. And the idea was that these absolute sovereigns should suppress religious wars, because the period of religious wars was, before the Second World War, the most terrible in European history, and especially in German history, because we were the battlefield of the 30 Years' War. But all the other European nations, including the United Kingdom, France, all the others, suffered terribly in that period of religious wars. So the modern state was invented, and a system of relations between these European states, absolute sovereigns, was also created, the so-called balance of power system. This system was blown up by the Democratic Revolution, the French Revolution. It was blown up by the Industrial Revolution. These were the two major changes, which led then in industrial warfare. America experienced the first industrial warfare during the Civil War. But more terrible was the First World War. And this brought Europe into a downward spiral. Totalitarian movements emerged during the war, the fascist movement, the Nazi movement, and the Bolshevik movement. And it ended up in a self-destruction during the Second World War of Europe, caused by Nazi Germany. And at the end, Europe was divided. The East was occupied by Stalin's Soviet Union, the West by the United States, and by the UK. And the idea at that time was to create in the West a new European system, which is not any longer based alone on sovereignty, but would be a system of a transformed sovereignty, where in integrated institutions, sovereignty should be pooled, a trans or supranational European system. This was a great idea. And if you compare, even as not non-professional historians, the first half of the European, of the 20th century, with the second half of the European century, then you will see a completely different outcome. And when the wall came down in 1989, when the Soviet Union disappeared at the end of 1990, and the Cold War was over, the Red Army went home, we had this idea spreading also in Eastern Europe. And it created fantastic results with all the given problems. But Europeans today are going to the negotiation table in Brussels, and not any longer to the battlefields. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes this business in Brussels is extremely boring. These endless nights, and these nitty-gritties, and whatever. So why is it not possible to achieve a compromise in the issue XYZ? Because there is a national interest, and on this national interest there is an election going on in a country where the specific national interest, I mean, makes that issue to a very important domestic issue, and suddenly you are stuck and you have to negotiate and renegotiate and again and again and again. Your wife is calling, when will you come home? I say, no, possibly not, and so on. And you really think, let's really knock the head against the wall. But then, suddenly, I always get the flash. These were exactly the reasons why our fathers and grandfathers went to the battlefield. Thanks God that we have now made that jump forward into a European Union, in a framework where we negotiate our, until we reach a compromise, our national interests. And this is a great success story. Here in Boston, Irish history is present. Today, the Irish Republic is the second richest country in Europe. It's a labor-importing country. Immigrants from other countries are going to Ireland, and Ireland is not any longer exporting its sons and daughters. Of course, this is based on hard work of the Irish people, on the cleverness of different governments in Ireland. But this was possible in the framework and with the support of the European Union. And this contributed a lot to change also the basics in Northern Ireland, thanks to Bertie Ahern, thanks to Tony Blair, but also thanks to the European Union, who transformed Northern Ireland. And which transformed Northern Ireland, which transformed also the whole situation in Ireland. If we look to the Mediterranean, I'm old enough to remember that we had Salazar, a proto-fascist dictatorship in Portugal. We had Franco, a fascist dictatorship in Spain. We had the military dictatorship in Greece. These were poor countries. When I came the first time in the mid-60s to Spain and Portugal, these were almost in the some parts of the country, this was low third world level. Today these are flourishing democracies. Nobody thinks about a coup d'etat any longer. These are modern countries, fascinating countries, strong civil societies and strong market economies, thanks to the integration into the European Union. And we will achieve the same success story with the new member states in Eastern and Southeastern Europe. I'm sure about that. If you look to the growth, if you look to the great figures, for example, of my country, with the new member states, I mean, it's a great success story, more important than our transatlantic trade and more important than our East Asia trade. So this will be also a big success story, and problems which we have will be transitional problems. I'll give you another example. Poland, Slovakia, Hungary are at the moment in domestic shaky or troublesome situations. What would happen if these countries wouldn't be embedded in the framework of the European Union? This would be an invitation, of course, for Russian diplomacy to play games. Today, the Baltic states, our eastern neighbors, southeastern neighbors, they are in a troublesome moment of their history, but it's a transitional part of their history. They will reach, again, firm ground for their democracy. Their economy is doing extremely well. And in the framework of the European Union, they are well protected and they can move forward in a common future. This is a fascinating experience. And once again, it was based on great statesmanship in the United States and in France. France was very important. At that time, the French Foreign Minister, Robert Schuman, and his secretary, Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Jean Monnet, were the key figures to develop these transnational institutions, which were at the beginning of the European Union. This is the perspective if you look back. If you look ahead, the situation is completely different. I have the privilege to live here now for 9 months in the United States and teach also in a wonderful university in Princeton at the Woodrow Wilson School. And this gives me the opportunity to see Europe not with American eyes, but through American eyes, and with some distance. And from the perspective of the United States, the Europeans are strange people. It's a good place to make holidays, no question about that. It's even a good place to live there, no question about that. For the time, we must take them serious in trade and economy. Euro is a pretty strong currency compared to the dollar. So we are proud about that. But, I mean, Europe does not really create problems. But can it contribute to solve problems? I mean, if you look to Europe, after the Constitution was rejected, they are disunited. They have disputes about strange, historically important, but strange issues. Which European state is closer to the U.S., which one is more powerful, less powerful, all this old European rubbish, it's still, I mean, in the center of the debate. Will Europe ever understand that it has strategic interests, responsibilities? Will it act based on a common will? Or will these, I've heard in Washington, the State Department, during my tenure as foreign minister, will this European mess continue forever? And there are many Europeans here. Let me be quite blunt. My impression is that in the United States, all these questions are answered in a negative way. The United States, let me put aside Iraq and the Middle East. But even Iraq and the Middle East can lead to a great disappointment. And the reaction will be that America will more and more turn its face into the Pacific Rim, driven by its interest, also by a big disappointment, which is a result of flawed American politics. So my reading of the American development is that the political elite, the scientific elite now is sending the children into Mandarin courses to learn Chinese, Japanese, maybe those who are more interested in a military career, Arabic. But the traditional European languages are under severe pressure. With one exception, it's English, but English is a lingua franca, so it's not any longer English, it's a world language. So if we read that and listen very carefully to the discussions in this country, so my impression is that America is following the course that it is important to deal with India and with China. Then there may be some backyards, some good places for holidays. It's still a risky Russia, but what matters is India and China, and not any longer Europe. We can say, okay, it's fine, we had our moment in history, why should we be concerned about that? But let me go back, take the blame, which is just now passing over Boston to Europe. Europe is not living on an island. We are in a lucky moment of our history. But to my European countrymen, especially to the younger, you must know geopolitically we live in a very dangerous neighborhood. We are not protected by two big oceans. If you look to Europe, yes, from the north, there is only one threat, climate change. In the west, as long as we have a strong alliance with the United States, and the United States will not apply for membership in the European Union, everything is fine. But let me start in the east. Russia will be our eternal neighbor. And as more the oil and gas price will rise, as more we will depend on Russia for the time being. The alternative is the Middle East and some other not very secure places. This is a matter of fact. I don't like it, but as a realist, I have to accept the facts. I think it's very important. I wouldn't be frightened to deal with Russia if we would have a strong Europe. We depend on Russia. Russia depends on us. But as long as Moscow can play the divided emperor game, it will be very risky for us. You heard and read a lot about the energy dependency of Europe from Russia. It wouldn't be a serious problem, at least not, if we would have one answer. If we would develop a common foreign energy policy. So when Putin tries to play with gas supplies and oil supplies, the only European answer could be and must be, okay, it's yesterday, we are living in a common market. Shortages on one economy in the European Union will have very negative consequences for all the others because we have a division of labor. You can't, for example, assemble German cars without Poland, Slovakia, Czechia, Hungary, the same with the French cars, whatever. If you would have a shortage and a shutdown of plants in Poland, within 3 days you would have the same effect in Scandinavia, in Benelux, in France, in Germany, in the UK. We live in a new reality, but definitely we don't draw the consequences. So if we would have, look to the trade, if we would have one foreign energy policy, the situation would be completely different. At the moment when Brussels has objections about a merger in your airline industry or about the behavior of Microsoft, this is very serious for your airline industry and Microsoft because Europe is your biggest market. So once there is a dispute with the Commission in Brussels, everybody jumps immediately in the next airliner flying to Brussels to settle the conflict and negotiate with the Commission because we have one voice. It's complicated to achieve a common European position as it is complicated in the United States to get a common position. But there, while we are unified, we are a power. In energy policy, we still follow the illusion we are separated. This is a national challenge. It might be a national challenge how you organize this, which kind of energy you mostly use. One is in favor of nuclear energy, others against it. This is not the issue I'm talking about. I'm talking about energy security outside of the European Union. There should be, I think, an answer, then I would be more optimistic of the European future. We have an interest with Russia, that Russia should develop to a democracy, and it will need a long time, and I'm not pessimistic about that. But even the most perfect Russia of our dreams will still be Russia. You shouldn't forget that. So it's a challenging neighborhood. What will happen with Belarus? With Moldova. We cannot allow black holes in our direct neighborhood. And Ukraine. I think it was very important that after enlargement, few months after enlargement, it was not the United States, it was at that time Europe. It were NGOs of the United States. I had a funny experience once. I mean, the Russians complained bitterly about American intervention in the Ukraine. I said, who? Who are you talking about? Well, George Soros. I said, oh, George Bush is also upset about George Soros because he also intervened in the American election. So this is not an American intervention. This is George Soros. I admire him very much for what he is doing, and I think it's very important. But I said, this is not the United States. Europe did the major job in the Ukraine, led by the Polish president and the Lithuanian president. And Ukraine is complicated. It's very easy to say they should join the European Union, but at least half of the population don't want to join the European Union. The east and west of the Ukraine is looking more to Moscow than to Brussels. The west is looking to Brussels and westwards. But the independence and the territorial integrity of the Ukraine is key. And when we would allow Russia, that Russia would go back towards its behavior to Europe and smaller states, to a policy of zone of influence, the old imperial policy, the security situation in Europe will change completely, fundamentally. And therefore, the Ukraine was so important. We must have an interest in a strong Europe, and especially the new member states. What I don't understand, if you calculate the interests of the new member states after 5 or even 7 decades of Soviet occupation, with this neighborhood, there is only one answer, a strong European Union and not Euroscepticism. But I believe these are transitional problems. Now let's move from the east to the southeast and the eastern Mediterranean. Or, before I come there, let's look to the south. Africa. Africa will be a challenge more for the Europeans than for the United States. We are morally responsible for a lot of the problems as Europe, for a lot of the problems of present Africa. But also we are the neighbor of this vast continent. Once Africa will start to export its conflicts and its problems, Europe will be address number one. Do we have a consistent European policy towards Africa? No, definitely not. Do we have a strong institutions, foreign policy institutions, who can do that based on the national foreign policy? No, we don't. We are now starting with immigration policy to try to coordinate that, but this won't be enough. When the immigrants arrived at the northern shores of the African continent, it's mostly too late. We must engage in Africa in a much more powerful way than we did it in the past, for the common future, and will be a huge challenge for us. But let's go to the Eastern Mediterranean, I think the most challenging neighborhood. Whether we like it or not, the Muslim world, the Middle East, is our regional neighbor. These conflicts are conflicts on our doorstep. In all European member states of the old European member states, we have strong Muslim minorities. So we cannot say farewell to the Middle East. Theoretically, the US could do so, but you have your strategic interests there and your allies. But Europe cannot say farewell. If I look to the present European policy, are we really aware about our responsibility? Positive answer, yes. Europe took over the burden, thanks to France and Italy, in Lebanon. It's not a formal European mission, but it's the first time that Europe really, took over the responsibility, and won't be the last time in that region. Europe is engaged in settling the Middle East conflict. Now the conflict between Israel, the tragic conflict between Israel and its Arab neighbors and the Palestinians, I think the only outcome can be a two-state reality, living side by side in two states. America will be key for security, but Europe, we are the most important trading partner for Israel, and we are the biggest donor for the Palestinians. I think Europe is very important in the question of peaceful transformation. If we will join our skills in a common strategy, the U.S. and Europe, I think we can achieve a lot. If not, we'll pay a high price for that, as we have seen it in the split in the run-up period for Iraq. But this region, ladies and gentlemen, this is my assessment, will be key in the next decades for European security. When this region will explode, the ramifications of such an explosion, the very negative one, will, I think, hurt Europe in a substantial way. And if this region can settle its conflict step by step and get out of this dark hole of terrorism, regional conflicts, of a crisis of modernization, and a lack of democracy and rule of law, and move forward, we will also be on the winning side. Unfortunately, there is no sense for strategic responsibility or strategic interests at the moment in Europe. I think this is one of the very negative developments we must see. The European people are tired about change. My impression is that at the moment they want to enjoy the economic boom, the fruits of the economic boom. They are tired by the transformation which started in 1989. The transformation costs, especially in the new member states, were extremely high. So a lot of the citizens were on the dark side of the transformation, especially when you were old, when you were a farmer, when you were in traditional industries like mining or steel, you were on the loser side. And this transformation at the end had not very much to offer. But understand the tiredness, that people are fed up with these transformations. When the wall came down, everybody was happy in Europe. It was a great excitement. I think it will never happen again during my life. It was, unbelievable. It was the spring of freedom. And it's like, when you have missed part of the family, you couldn't believe that they ever will come back, and suddenly it knocks at the door and you open the door and they are there. Come in. It's a big, a joyful moment. It's hugs and kisses and tears and festivities all over. But then after 2 weeks, there are not enough bedrooms in the morning. Well, once again, these nephew always blocks the bathroom or what's going on. Reality comes back. And that exactly took place also in Europe, to be frank. And the only answer was, this house is too small for the enlarged family. We have, to construct new parts, so we need a bigger house. This is the only answer. But then the big question was, a bigger house, we must finance the loans. So all the old present members of the family were called into a room and said, we need a bigger house. Yes, we definitely need a bigger house. Everybody agreed. But we must pay for a bigger house. Yes, you pay for the bigger house. But we are poor. What we can't pay. This took place in the 90s. And this led to the Treaty of Nice. And before, it led to the financial agreements in Berlin. And then we move forward, and tried to find an architect, construction industry, because the financial at the end was settled, financial issues. And then it started. No, I don't want the bedroom here. I want the bedroom here and an additional bathroom. It's ridiculous. We are moving now forward into an environmental future, so an additional bathroom is impossible. But I want a separate room for my children, but we can't pay for that separate room. Suddenly there was a bitter debate about the future of the European house, and we are still in this bitter debate. This is the present situation. And then you look over the fence to the neighbor, strange things are going on there. He starts to buy again terrible dogs. He promised that never again he will buy such terrible dogs, but suddenly he's still, there is again such a terrible dog running around in the neighborhood. You see that there are, violence is coming up in your neighborhood, but we are, well, fighting about new rooms and how the architecture of the new room should be. This is exactly the European situation. And when we look to the Middle East, ladies and gentlemen, we can't go around Turkey. Now, for American audience, to make quite clear, it's a very, very sensitive issue. From the domestic emotional quality, it would be the same if Europe would ask America, the United States, for the sake of stability in Central America, to accept not only the Central American states, but also Mexico. This guy is crazy. That's what you thought now. Huh? But you can't compare that in the strategic sense. But the emotional quality to accept Turkey as an EU member is more or less the same. Nevertheless, the strategic situation is a very different one. The question of the modernization of the Islamic world is a common challenge. And my assessment is that the crisis of modernization is the core out of which all these confrontations, terrorism, and all the other terrible developments spread up. It's a crisis of modernization. If you look to the Arab world, the half of the population under 18, if you raise the bar, you will have 70, 80% up to 25. A lack of jobs, a lack of education, publishing, Netherlands publishes more books per year than the whole of the Arab world. Read the report, the UNDP report about the Arab world, written by scientists and businessmen of the Arab world. If you compare the dynamic of Israel, for example, one of the most modern post-industrial societies, and they started in 48, if you compare that with the situation in the Arab world, then you will understand the difference and the challenges. So if you put demography together with these very severe crises of modernization of the basic facts, it's a recipe for disaster. And this directly on the European doorsteps. So from my assessment, it will be key that we understand that Turkey will play here a very important role. 9/11 took place in your country, and jihad terrorism is a very serious challenge. But the answer, the serious answer, won't be a military one. The serious answer will be whether a big Muslim country, can successfully modernize itself. Is there a way into a modern future based on Islam? Yes, it is. If not, Europe would be lost. Maybe not the US, but Europe. I mean, if there is the only way an explosion and a terrible disaster in the Muslim world, because this would, their culture wouldn't fit to globalization. I mean, this would be disastrous for us. And therefore, Turkey is so important. Look to the present developments, very negative. But why? Once Europe withdraws its hand and its support, Turkey is going back into its old contradictions. As long as the European perspective was a credible one, Europe had an important influence, not based on the barrel of the gun, but on the perspective, if you reform, if you move forward, one day you will have, we will have a serious decision whether you will belong to us or not. And if we reject Turkey, then I think we also reject a positive answer to the challenge of terrorism and crisis in the Middle East. Now, if I would say to a, in a seminar of management of a management school, okay, we merge a company with another company which is, well, almost as big as your own company. So we had 15 member states, old member states, and we have 12 new member states. Some others will follow, but now we have 12. So we merged and had now a company which has the size from 15 to 27. And then after the merger, the policy of the management will be nothing will change, everything will, we will keep everything in place. This would be a recipe for disaster, of course. You can't run a company almost double the size without streamlining the institutions, because otherwise the results will be lousy or even dangerous. And this is exactly the consequence after enlargement. A wise management would have reconsidered and acted before, but we failed in Nice. We tried it, but we failed the last time. We tried it in Amsterdam, and we failed. And it was tried, and this was the beginning of the European crisis in Maastricht. In Maastricht, the strong part of the Maastricht Treaty was the common currency, but the weak part was an illusion of a European Union. Headlines, goals, but not really, I mean, substantive agreements about the institutions. And since then, there is a pending crisis which reached its climax with the Non in France and in the Netherlands. Do not misunderstand me now. If the UK have voted no, or say Sweden, or Czechia, it would have been severe. But at the end, I think it could have been managed. But it's impossible without France. Why? Because this new Europe is, strangely enough, based on the reconciliation of the two Carolingian people, the French and the Germans. A Europe without Germany would mean a French Germany, and this is a non-starter. A Europe without France would be would mean a German, European, German Europe, and this is definitely a complete non-starter. So only if these two neighbors, which are so different, are following the same course, Europe can work. It's not enough. It's not exclusive. In a reunion of 25, definitely, all the others are needed. But if France and Germany are split, this is the big stumbling block. And this will continue to be so. So from my point of view, the French no was, I mean, a very serious moment in the development of the European Union. Looking from outside, it seemed to be so easy. Yes, we need a strong coordinating common foreign policy. We must have the disputes before, but then decide and move forward together. it makes no sense to dream about sovereignty of the 19th and 20th century. It's gone. It's the past. The future will be defined by mega powers like China and India. Even the U.S. will be a small power if you look down 20, 30 years down the road of history. It will be a complete changed world. And even the most powerful European nations, France and the UK, and even the most powerful, economic powerful European nation, and the three biggest, France, UK and Germany, are underperformer, family-owned small businesses compared to the new reality in the 21st century. And it's not because we want to be, play with the big boys or girls. This is not the issue. It's not about prestige. If you look to Europe, we depend from the world. We have our interests there. A lot of jobs, our welfare system, the whole way Europeans want to live, and this is a bipartisan approach, it's going from conservative to green, back and forth, depends on our positioning in the world economy. If there will be a decline, it will be a decline with very, very negative consequences in Europe. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, I think it will be key that we move forward with the institutional reforms. However you will name the baby, I would say as one of the fathers, name it as ever you like. But if you want to change the baby, this is not a good idea. We need the institutional reforms. Many times, now it's Mrs. Merkel. I haven't voted for her, the German chancellor. But if it's Tony Blair or Jacques Chirac, okay. Because these are big nations and the American president is used to deal with these leaders. But if there is someone from Austria or Belgium or wherever, smaller and middle-sized countries. And I don't want to be arrogant, I'm just describing the reality. The American president asks, who is this? What I'm doing here? Why is that this only guy talking to me? But after he stopped, another popped up. So when I deal with Europeans in these boring American-European consultations, I speak, and then four Europeans speak. Why is that so? And his people will tell him, forget it, do it. Don't bother about that. It will go by, and it's done for the next 6 months. You laugh. I tell you, based on experience, this is the reality. First of all, the presidency changing every 6 months. So the American president is told, this is a European president, but forget the name, you don't must know it. In 6 months, it's another chap. So you don't need it to know the name. Then the president of the commission, then the foreign commissioner, then the real foreign minister, the foreign policy representative. So it's a chap. It sounds funny. But it's really self-weakening for the European Union. You can't create efficient results with these structures. And now in an enlarged union, where you have greater differences in between the economic basics, more of a variety of foreign policy traditions, which are not always, you cannot always harmonize, which are conflicting. This is a situation where we are, and we must overcome that. And secondly, I think it will be very important to move also forward, as I mentioned it, with our policies. We need a common policy towards Russia. If I would have a wish, I would say this should be an issue negotiated between Washington and Brussels to really, move forward with a common, consistent strategy. Because Russia is too important to stay on the sideline. This is the present situation. We move forward, I think, up to the end of the decade, whether we continue with our success story with stronger institutions, or I think the wheel will go back. In Germany, you have now still a strong consensus that the country is committed to a European future, not in a naive way, but still strongly committed. But once this strong Europe will be substantially questioned according to the timeline, then you will see that there will be also reconsiderations in my country. And I think this is not in our interest and not in the interest of Europe. So inside the European Union, there are good reasons to move forward, and outside in our neighborhood. And last but not least, everybody who believes in a strong transatlantic relationship, I say that to our British friends, the transatlantic relationship will disappear or have no real substance anymore in future with a weak Europe. Only with a strong Europe, I think the transatlantic relationship will be a strong one, and we should have any interest on both sides of the Atlantic to have such a strong transatlantic relationship. There we are, ladies and gentlemen. In the moment, it's very complicated in Europe, but nevertheless, it's a wonderful continent with wonderful people, a great success story, but big challenges ahead of us. Thank you very much.
Former Foreign Minister and Vice Chancellor of Germany, Joschka Fischer, speaking tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. Mr. Fischer's lecture was titled Germany and the Future of Europe and was presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations. We began with an introduction by International Relations Department Chairman Eric Goldstein. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Mike Toda with Tim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.